I had a difficult time finding my way through the text today because they're so disjointed. But my intuition when I chose them were that they were the right pieces. I had originally chosen an image that was of a man who'd made the crossing of the Mediterranean, a Syrian father, and he has etched on his face what looks like agony, but it is a deep joy, and it shows a past of agony in making it across that passage with his young daughter who survived with him. But I chose not to show it because it wasn't as joyful as this picture here. But both are the stories of refugees and immigrants. We live in the tension between this picture of the Syrian refugees here in Tucson and their sweet sail, and I'll tell that story in a moment, and the ones who've just made their way across, and the ones who are waiting to come to our country, and the ones who are afraid, so very afraid right now. I stood with the knowledge of the murder of the two men from India, whose homeland was India, at whom someone had yelled to go back to their home, to their country. I stood with that family thinking about what it's like to stay in a country, their promised land, after two of their loved ones were murdered. I stood hearing the words of the two executive orders of January with urging extreme vetting of immigrants and refugees. I stood with the children of Southwest Key, with whom I do a service every week, 300 children who are seeking asylum in the United States, who this particular Wednesday were particularly quiet after the Homeland Security announcement that any of the 11 million immigrants in the U.S., regardless of their immigration status, where they are in the process, could be deported at a moment's notice. And I held on to Isaiah's vision, which is so powerful. And I remembered that it was written for people who were finding their way back to Judah and Jerusalem after they were destroyed, after the Assyrian battles which laid waste to their homelands, and they were forced out, forced into exile, as many of the refugees are today. This is our story, our faith story. And they lived there in Babylon for 60 years. A whole generation passes before Isaiah lays out the foundation of their return. The ones who had fled are no longer alive. The ones who are returning do not remember the sights and the smells and the sounds and the texture and the feeling of being the people of God in the sanctuary that was the temple. They have no sense memory of that. They are going home to something that they don't know, with just the stories that their ancestors have told them. But they have lived a life of relative ease, and they're being called to go home. Isaiah paints this beautiful picture of their going home, and even the mountains and the earth and the oceans are called in to rejoice. All of creation, humanity, and animals, and the earth, and the air, and the water are called to restoration to their full God-given potential, a vision where they'll never be thirsty or hungry again, where Mother God remembers the babe at her breast and always remembers them, is always with them, and will return with them on their journey home. Some people say that church should not be political, and I'm here to say that it's in our bones. It's in our DNA as people of faith. When I read the Isaiah passage to the children at Southwest Key, they could not imagine that for them. They could not imagine ever returning home to Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras. They couldn't imagine, because their home had been laid to waste by progress, by climate change, by exploitation for the natural resources that were there. They couldn't imagine returning to rivers and mountains, because they'd never seen mountains that rose up high that hadn't been eaten away for use for gravel, for construction, for cement, or rivers that hadn't been polluted. They couldn't imagine returning home to a church where all people were welcome. They couldn't imagine returning home where the rulers cared for them, where they would never be hungry or thirsty again. These children are caught between two options. Either they will go forward to live with a family member who is documented. They've been vetted before they even got to the U.S. They are here legally, but they know that if they get to make that next step and it's completely unclear with the new directives from the new administration, that they will live a difficult life. And maybe their children will remember, but their children and their children's children will have forgotten the passage, which is why we're called to remember that passage today. There are so many passages in Scripture for those who say that we shouldn't be political, and I want to just name some of them for you, references to aliens and refugees and immigrants. There shall be one law for the native and for the alien who resides among you, from Exodus. Moses gives God's law, saying, "You shall not wrong or oppress a resident alien, for there were aliens in the land of Egypt." Leviticus, "You shall not strip your vineyards bare, leave them for the poor and the alien." When the alien resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress the alien. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizens among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. And from Numbers, you shall have one statute for both the resident alien and the native. Deuteronomy, give the members of your community a fair hearing and judge rightly between one person and another, whether citizen or resident alien. The people of Israel are made aware that the land has come to them as a gift from God, and they were to remember that they were once aliens themselves. The law, cursed be anyone who deprives the alien of justice. And that's just the first five books of Hebrew Scriptures. And then the three Gospels, love your neighbor as yourself. We have the story of immigrants and refugees in the Bible, of Adam and Eve who were forced from the garden, of Noah who builds an ark to flee the flood, of Abram and Sarai who leave the country of their kindred. Lot takes his family and flees Sodom. Jacob migrates with his family to Egypt because of famine. Joseph brings his brothers to Pharaoh in Egypt, and Pharaoh gives them jobs. The Israelites are driven out of Egypt. Moses, Miriam, and Aaron lead the Israelites into the wilderness, to the promised land, so-called, of Canaan. Mary and Joseph take the babe Jesus and flee from persecution to Egypt. And today we have the reading of, after 60 years of exile, a new generation beginning the long walk home to Judah and Jerusalem. This is a story of restoration and return, and I would say the transformation of a people. Not that God caused their suffering, but through suffering, they became something new. As I was trying to put together some words to speak to you today, I took myself to a movie, which I sometimes do to let the words move around in me. I went to see Lion. Has anybody seen that movie? It's a powerful movie, and it's billed as a feel-good movie. And I don't usually go to feel-good movies, but I just had the inclination that this might be a good one. I mean, I don't like manufactured feel-good. sort of Hollywood feel good. I want to get there myself and not be brought to that place, obviously. And that was exactly what I found in this movie. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's a story of a real life person from India named Saru Bierli. It was a very well-timed movie in light of what's going on in our country. It's a story of a five-year-old boy, Saru, a true story, who lives with his mother, who breaks rocks with her hands in a quarry in order to eke out a survival for her family with her two sons and daughter. But it's not enough. And so Saru's older brother is going to go far away, as many families today, the oldest son goes to try to make money to send back to the family. It's a common story. And little Saru wants to go. He's only five, but he lifts a bicycle and he shows his older brother how strong he is. And his brother finally decides that Saru can go with him. And so they go and they get to a train station in a city that's pretty far away. And his brother goes to find the next connection. And Saru falls asleep on a bench in the train station. And when he wakes up, it's absolutely silent, which is strange in a train station in India. And Saru gets up and you feel the horror in his body and on his face. And he runs around screaming his brother's name. And he finally gets on a train that's parked. And he looks, he runs down the aisles. It's a passenger train and no one's on it. And suddenly the door's closed. And he's locked inside and the train begins to move. Thousands and thousands of miles he goes, trapped inside this train by himself, eating the trash that's on the floor, looking out the window. You feel those miles as he goes across India, far from his brother, who's surely looking for him, and his mother, who's surely missing him, and his sister. He finally arrives in Calcutta, which is a town, city, huge, teeming city, full of people. He gets off at the train station, a five-year-old little boy who can't speak the language and can't tell people what's going on. He runs, he lives on the street. He eats what garbage he can find. He sleeps wherever he can. He watches the people who have more than he has. And finally, he's picked up by an orphanage, a pretty terrible place where he goes, and you get a hint of what is in front of him if he stays there. And a lovely family from Tasmania, Australia, adopt him. And they are so happy to see him, a white family. And they take him to Australia and they raise him as their son. We know this at the end of the story, but in the beginning we don't know that this family has chosen not to have children because their children are the children of the world, like Saru. He grows up and he keeps having little clues of his past, a smell, a sound, a sight. He goes into deep depression and estrangement from his family and his girlfriend and his friends, a depression that threatens to kill him. And he starts to have more and more glimpses, and he finally figures out, he makes the journey back in his mind to where he's from, and he makes that passage home. It's a powerful story. And the end shows the real Saru, who's a lot darker than the actor who plays him. But the actor who plays him is really handsome and easy to watch. It's a wonderful, true story. And then we have this story of the Syrian women. There's so much hope going on in Tucson. The Syrian women is a part of the Arizona Welcomes Refugees Project, which I highly recommend to you. You can look for them on Facebook. And they do a lot of things. They go and meet refugees at the airport, and they set families up in apartments, and they provide them what they need, and they take them to appointments, and they accompany them. It's a beautiful, beautiful project. But somebody had the idea of having this sweet sale, so it started at Grace St. Paul, and they brought the sweets, and they sold out in less than an hour. There were over 100 people there. So a few weeks later, this was in December, they had another one, and there were 300 people at that sweet sale. And then they had another one, and there were 500 people at that sweet sale, and all the while they're selling out. So the next one they had at Temple Emmanuel, which is a Jewish synagogue here in town, there were 1,000 people there. And the next time they had it at the YWCA, and there were 1,500 people there. And it was a raucous and beautiful scene. It was an Isaiah scene of people welcomed, of people at home. We know that that's not the full picture because there's still a lot ahead of them, but it's a snapshot of the kingdom of heaven here on earth. Scott Grizzell took this picture and a lot of other pictures, and if you want to see Joy Incarnate, if you want to see Mardi Gras, Shrove Tuesday or Sunday, look at those pictures. It is a before and after or a middle. I don't have a good end to this sermon. We're on a journey between these two passages, between the sending out, between the terror and horror and loss of identity, between the loss of self and one's new country, between the threats and dangers that lie there, between the individual goodness and goodness of communities that's awakening in our churches and synagogues and mosques today. There is goodness stirring in the world. I want to end by reading again a little of what you heard in the beginning of worship and a little more that Isaiah says to God's people on their return. I will say to the prisoners, come out, and to those who are in darkness, show yourselves. Congested roadways will become places where they can safely graze, and barren heights will become lush pasture land for them. They will never hunger or thirst, and scorching wind and sun will never plague them. For the one who has compassion on them will lead and guide them to the springs of water. I will make roads through all the mountains, and my highways will be raised up because they are on their way from afar, from north or west, others from the land of Aswan. Shout for joy, you heavens! Exalt, you earth, you mountains! Break into happy cries! For God consoles the people and takes pity on those who are afflicted. But the people said, God has abandoned me. God has forgotten me. Does a woman forget her baby at the breast or fail to cherish the child at her womb? Yet even if these forget, I will never forget you. Look and see, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are forever before me. Though you were ruined and desolate and your land laid waste, your land will soon be too small for its inhabitants, and those who ruined you will be far away. The children you thought you had lost will say in your hearing, we need more room to live in. This place is too small for us. Then you will say in your heart of hearts, who gave birth to these for me? I was bereaved and barren. Who raised them when I was in exile? I was by myself. Where did they come from? Thus says God, the Sovereign One, I will send a message to all nations and hoist my signal to the peoples, and they will bring your daughters and sons, holding them in their arms, carrying them on their shoulders. Rulers shall become their foster parents, nursing and nurturing them. May it be so. Amen.